topic and we go on for years. And so in a short period of time, it's very hard to discuss the entire body of what we call Choshen Mishpat, which is the 1/4 of the Shulchan Aruch, which talks about monetary law. So therefore, I thought I would discuss a couple of things and then open the floor for questions you may have about the business world. Of course, we understand very well that we have to be honest in our business dealings. We should understand very well. Some of us don't, unfortunately. We know that there is a prohibition against stealing. And I'm going to tell you now in very clear and unambiguous terms, the prohibition against stealing applies not only to stealing from Jews, but to stealing from non-Jews as well. This is the Psak Halacha. It's a Torah prohibition to steal from a non-Jew. If you look at the Rambam, there are certain nuances. The Rambam gives an impression that to steal in the sense of Geneva, you probably learned somewhere that there's a difference in Geneva and Zela. Who knows the difference in Geneva and Zela? Yes?
One's open, one's
right, open. Correct. One's open, one's surreptitious. So when it comes to Geneva, the Rambam seems to completely equate stealing from a Jew and stealing from a non-Jew. Absolutely no difference whatsoever. None. Open the first Rambam and Hilchos Geneva. The same exact thing. Same. No difference whatsoever. With respect to Gzela, there's certain nuances there. In the Rambam at the beginning, you get an impression from the Rambam that the actual Losigzel itself perhaps is not applied to non-Jews, and presumably the reason would be, as the Noda B'Yuda explains, the Torah says, Lo Sashok, this week's parasha, Lo Sashok es Re'acha v'lo Sigzol. And the Rambam seems to say that Lo Sigzol goes back to the Re'acha which precedes it. Re'acha usually means Jews to the exclusion of non-Jews. Remarkably, in the same parasha of Kedoshim we're going to read this week, Lo Tignovu v'lo Sechachashu v'lo Sechakru ish Ba'am Yisrael. So there, ironically, there the Am Yisrael comes at the end. So you would think that it would modify Tignovu, Lo Tignovu as well. It does not. And the Ritva explains why not. It has to be a Balkari for this. Lo Tignovu. It's not. I don't want a Balkari. Lo Tignovu, period. A new sentence starts. Lo Sechachashu, Lo Sechakrish Ba'am Yisrael. It's a new sentence. But Lo Tignovu applies to all people, Jewish and non-Jewish, identically. Whereas the other pasuk, Lo Sashok Es Re'acha V'lo Sigzol, the Rambam seems to understand, as none of you would explain, it refers back to the previous word, and therefore it's not a direct, identical prohibition. Rather, it's derived from other sources in the Gemara Masechta Baba Kama, Daf Kuf Yud Gimel on the base, a number of different sources, which I don't have time to go into right now, but nonetheless it stands as a Torah prohibition. To me, it's clear, is the psak. In any event, unfortunately, most of the people of our faith who are guilty of these sins are not doing it in the fashion of Gzeil. We don't have too many shoplifters amongst our people. Most of it is surreptitious, which is Lo Tignovu, which according to the Rambam, is literally identical with respect to Jews and non-Jews alike. And the reason perhaps can be based upon the Minchas Chinuch, who says that Lo Tignovu, as opposed to Lo Tigzol, is not just a matter of money. It's a matter of what we'll call midos, of character. If a person is surreptitious, is sneaky, that's bad character. We have in the Gemara Masechta Tachul and Tzadi Dalet, that even in the Isra of Gnevas Das, you're not stealing his money, his property, you're stealing his mind. What does that mean? You're fooling him. And it's clear in the Gemara that applies to Jews and non-Jews alike. It's clear. So therefore we understand that's a common thread to the violation of Geneva. That's just by way of introduction. For this reason, we have to be so careful in all of our dealings not to take from others that which does not belong to us. People have all kinds of, what we call horoas heter. They find ways to rationalize. And the truth is, this Horos Heter has halachic consequences. Mar seems to tell us that if there's a case in which people around think it's okay, even though it's absolutely not okay, an individual who's guilty will not be disqualified from testimony or from taking an oath. Because, the inchi mashmalu, the Gemara puts it, that people think it's this way, it's not that, it's that way. That's a reality that people have made these mistakes from time immemorial. And I would say that as a rule of thumb, a person has a question when it comes to these things, would do well to ask a rabbi. You know, we are trained, we ask rabbis, we have a question with kashrut. Someone came to me today, what was your question? It was meatballs, and it was part of a soup, and it spilled on a baking tin. He comes to a rabbi. Well, the same thing, the question, you know, I money, and I took this money, and I'm not sure it's my money. Always come to the rabbi. But no, that I can decide myself. The rabbi knows the laws of baking tins and meatballs and soup. He studied that. But when it comes to whether this money is mine or not, what do I need the rabbi for? You know, the Mefarshim explained when they're reading that Pirkei Avos. The Pirkei Avos starts Moshe, Kibbutz, Torah, Misina. What's obviously, we need it to tell you that only Moshe, Kibbutz, Torah, Misina, we learn Mesef the Shabbos. You know, how do you keep Shabbos? How do you keep Rosh Hashanah? But almost, which is Ben Adam L'Chavero, ethics, is also the cute Messina. So you should ask a question. Now, of course, it's always dangerous when you ask a question of monetary law, because you're only giving your one side of the issue. You present it such and such a way, you left out 10 details. So the rabbi will always have to give you what we call an if-then answer. And if you didn't give the rabbi the full question, and you're guilty of theft, it's not the rabbi's fault, it's your fault. You didn't give the complete picture. So when people ask me this question, I often say, I can't give you an answer. I only heard one side. But sometimes I'll tell them, even according to their one side, that they're wrong. But even if I think they're right, I said, I always have add a caveat. It's basically what you're telling me. I can't vouch for the truth of what you're telling me. You have to add something, you left out something. But you should learn to ask questions in these areas as well. Okay, so we've summarized that Geneva, Jews and non-Jews are identical. Zela, they are, even though we pass in Gezel, Akon, Osam, and Atorah, there could be some certain nuanced differences between Jews and non-Jews. This is implicit in the Rambam. Okay. The workplace is a difficult place because, you know, especially for those of you who have grown up your whole life in the yeshiva, it's like a cocoon. It's like a Tevas Noach, where the rest of the world is sinking and we're somewhat floating thanks to the Torah. Once you got into the workplace, aside from the purely monetary care you must take and not in being honest in your business, and remember, when a person goes up to heaven after 120 years, the very first question they ask, before Kavata Itan La Torah, where has been a Torah? Before they have to ask, they ask one other question. What's that called? Nosasa v'nosata v'emuna. They want to know what your business dealing is done with truth. So we try very hard to be truthful in our business dealings, and we should really even go what we call beyond the letter of the law, what we call the Fnim Ishur HaTadim, which is based on the pasuk V'asisa HaYosher V'HaTov in our business relationships. And as a matter of fact, it's so critical for Kiddush Hashem. You know, the Gemara tells us in Masechta Yuma, Daf Pei Vav, what's a Kiddush Hashem versus a Chilul Hashem? If someone who's known as someone who's an observant Jew, and he's polite, Dibura B'nachas HaMavriyos, and for our purposes, Maso Matano Be'emuna, his business dealings are honest, people say about him, wow, fortunate are his parents who brought him up in the Torah way. Fortunate are his rabbis who taught him Torah. Wow, this is good. Terrific. And the reverse is the reverse. You look it up. This makes it incumbent upon us to maximize opportunities for Kiddush Hashem, even if we're going beyond the letter of the strict law. I'll give you an example. There's a story told in the Yerushalmi and in the Medrash where Shimon ben Shetach bought a donkey from an Arab. And on the donkey, there was a very valuable jewel. Now, technically speaking, it's called an aveda, a lost item. When it comes to a lost item, the Torah tells us explicitly, adrosh achicha also, that you have to return lost items to your brothers. Whoever learned Elam Metzias here in youth. That's how people usually start Gemara. So it's clear the entire opening topic of Elam Metzias, that if something is lost by a non-Jew, technically speaking, there's no need to return it to that non-Jew. Because why? In the non-Jewish world, in those days, was finders, keepers, losers, weepers. So we are not required to go the extra measure of Hashavas Aveda. Today may be different, different laws, but we're not going there right now. So Shimon Meshedach, his students discover, he said, wow, now you're rich, you struck it rich, you have a diamond. So Shimon Meshedach responded, you think I'm a barbarian? I bought a donkey, I didn't buy a diamond. And I don't want people to say about me that I'm a bad guy. He returned the diamond. And the response of the non-Jew to whom he returned the diamond was, Brich Eloka de Shimon ben Shetach. Blessed is the God of Shimon ben Shetach. We call it a Kiddush Hashem opportunity. Technically speaking, could have kept the diamond. But why are we in this world? What's Shimon ben Shetach teaching us? What are we doing in this world? We're in this world for Kiddush Hashem. So if you have the opportunity to do Hashavas Aveda, and it'll be known that you, as an observing Jew, yeshiva graduate, did it, it'll be a Kiddush Hashem. There can be cases, I'll admit that, where that's impossible. Where it's impossible to fulfill Kiddush Hashem in your Hashavas Aveda, because it'll be unknown, you know, who did it, they'll never figure out that you're Jewish, or that you're Orthodox, it'll be impossible. Then it may be a different story, Hashavas Aveda may be permissible in certain circumstances. Again, pending local laws, etc. But if the opportunity exists to be Mekadosh Shem Shemayim, it absolutely must be done. That's what we're here for. What happens if you damage the property of a non-Jew? We've spoken about so far stealing from him, which is prohibited. Surreptitiously, it's the same as a Jew. And if you have the chutzpah of shoplift, it's I'm not sure shoplift may also be considered gnei. Because the idea is I go over to you, I rob you, armed robbery. That's what's called gzeila.
Armed is prohibited. Because it's gzeila.
Whatever it may be. But gzeila is not allowed, but if I do, whatever it may be. Hashava Saveda may be somewhat different. What about Nezek? Then you learn Baba Kama. What if I damage you? So it's clear in the Gemara and Baba Kama, the distinction is drawn with respect to a Shor Shel Yisrael, Shel Nogach, Shor Shel Goy. There's certain changes and leniencies. That's where my ox. Who owns an ox over here? Anybody own an ox? So we don't have this guy show nowadays. We do have is this guy other, where a person causes damage. What Salah the Chazon Ish says that this, the change between Jews and non-Jews only applies to a shor, does not apply to human damage. If you break a non-Jew's window, you have to pay. Remember Rabbi Zilberstein Shlita, as Rabbi Yosha's son-in-law has a lot of tapes. He was once on a bus in East Jerusalem, and some pranksters, Jewish pranksters, took a stone they had in their pocket and smashed a car of the Arab East Jerusalem. So he stopped the bus. They told you guys, you have to pay, because the Chazon Ish says you caused damage to a non-Jew. Go out and pay. I'm going to call the police. On the other hand, there are others who disagree. The Minchas Chinuch seem to disagree and say, based on the Tosus in the Sefer Baba Kama, much earlier, the Tosus seems to say that if a human being causes damage to Hekdesh, to property of the Beis HaMikdash, you would be potter. And in those sugyas, they seem to equate non-Jews with Hekdesh. He thinks to say you would be exempt. This is an unresolved question. Far be it from you and me to try to resolve it. Therefore, I say that certainly in a case in which a Kiddush Hashem is possible, you should pay. I'll tell you a story that happened to me. This goes back many years. I was once asked on a snowy Mosi Shabbos to drive someone back into the dangerous part of the Bronx. I live in Riverdale. Riverdale is considered to be a safe part. But between this part and my part, a lot of hills. You have to go down a hill and then back up a hill. Okay. So I drove a certain individual there. And on the way back, I was driving down a hill on a very snowy night. This hill is so dangerous that in the interim, many years ago, they grooved the pavement. You know what that means? It means when you go down that hill, so it's a windy hill, it's grooved. It's people are losing traction. This is before it was grooved. It's a snowy night. I'm going down very slowly, because I know it's slow as can be. But I turn the car to the right, because the hill is turning this way. And a chutzpah, the car doesn't listen. I turn it, and the car just keeps going straight this way. Thank God there was no oncoming traffic because no one was out. Only the Shigoyim were out that night. It was a snowy night. I see, thank God I'm wearing my seatbelt, I'm ready for a crash landing. I mean, there's no question. It's caught us and doesn't respond. I'm about to crash. So I hold myself tight and you know, going very slowly, even the nano slowly, boom, I crashed into a car. Never happened before, but I crashed into a car. I don't want to drive. I knew, but the car, the chutzpah of the car, wouldn't turn. No. It was in the middle of a very dangerous section of the Bronx. I was afraid to get out. To call, who knows, they'll come stoning me. I don't know what. But I thought maybe I have to pay. So I jotted down the number of the license plate. And I got out of that mess. And then I got home. Called the police. I said, I was driving. And, this is the license plate. Nor that I'd leave a note. I was afraid to get out. To get out of the car there. So I said, can you please notify the person who owns this license of this car that if they call this number, then I will try to give restitution for what damage that I caused. So sure enough, I saw the car as a jalopy, a bigger jalopy than mine, which is saying something. But nonetheless, so the person calls up, a woman called up and said, thank you so much, the police called me. As you may have seen, there was a dent in the front. My car's 150 dents. I don't care about an extra dent. But because it was in the front, I couldn't open my trunk. And it cost me $75. Then a locksmith to open my trunk. I said, fine, send your check for $75. Give me your address, your name. I sent the check. And I never do this. I put on my return address, Rabbi Willick. Understand why? This is Shimon Meshetach. The rabbi who could have gotten away with it, no one would have seen me. But I felt it was important enough to call the police and get out of there. Okay? Kiddush Hashem. Something similar happened to me. Oh, also the snow. And my own block. I was parking my car. When you park your car, it's parked to be a little tricky between two cars. And I went this way, and a chutzpah, the car wouldn't listen again. It was the same car. But it was the wind wheel, and it banged into the car in front of me. This time I wasn't afraid. I left a note. I banged your car, and here's my phone number. Call me. You know who it was? My next door neighbor on my floor in my apartment house. We were both right out of the house. He called me. I think he's even Jewish. I paid him too. He's Jewish. I wouldn't pay him. I didn't know he was Jewish. The first case I was quite sure was not Jewish. Because in that neighborhood, there's no Jews. The second one, I didn't even know. So those are my two tales of woe, driving in the snow. So I'll give you a piece of advice. Stay home. If you can stay home in the snow, it's good advice. I'm just trying to bring out, we have opportunities for Kiddush Hashem, we should not squander them. This can happen to you at the checkout counter. If you're identifiably Jewish, at the checkout counter, it happened to me more than once, they gave me a 10 instead of a 5. They changed it to 20, they made a mistake. Sam, see, you made a mistake, you gave me a 10 instead of a 5. Thank you very much. And you see, I'm wearing a yarmulke or whatever. So that's what I could keep it technically, maybe. It's a very bad answer. They made a mistake. Tosko Akum, it's like a Vedas Akum. But when I say Akum, I should be hasten to add that most stores today are not Akum. Maybe a gas station is owned by a particular non-Jewish person. A lot of these big stores are public companies. Public companies are owned by combinations of Jews and non-Jews. And therefore, if it's even a minority Jewish ownership on a simple level, you're required to give it back to make restitution to the Jewish owner, not just as a Kiddush Hashem, but as a strict requirement of a Shabbos Aveda proper. Keep this in mind. People kind of stunts, people think that, well, it's like the government. We love to pick on the government. The government is also, I'm giving you a firm rule here. No one is allowed to steal from the government. Uncle Sam, that's a pretty Jewish name, Sam. But even Uncle Sam, we treat it as a non-Jew, as I said earlier in this year, for those who came in late, is a total prohibition of stealing from non-Jews. So as a result, there's a total prohibition of stealing from government. Let's discuss it. Here's the problem. Many Jews came over from Europe. And in Europe, the governments were murderers. Anti-Semitic murderers at that. So there was a mitzvah to take anybody. Every money they had, they could use to kill Jews. So in those times, there was no obligation to give to the government what they were entitled to. There's nothing wrong with taking from that government. Like taking from pirates. So they were. Some people don't realize when they crossed the Atlantic and came to America, which were much rising a very fiery tshuva, is a malchus shel chesed, and you're not allowed to take from the government, which is not yours. And even if some little low bureaucrats are going to say it's okay, it's still not okay. You can't, he said, panic, the lunch programs he's talking about over there. I'm sure you all realize it's not allowed. I'm telling you anyway. It's a malchus shel chesed, and Hashem hates when people will take from ill-gotten gains and use them for Torah. It's terrible. The whole fiery tshuva Rav Moshe has. So that's the problem. In some places, they think they're still in Europe. Unfortunately, to our great shame, there are even certain, we'll call them, rabbinic figures that have been implicated in some of these kinds of activities. And one celebrated instance which started, which was actually the case was heard in California, well, the person's a resident of New York, somehow our states get together to a lot, explained himself in a court deposition, you know, this is the way it's done. And there was some kind of an excuse that this is the way it's done. What do you mean this is the way it's done? It was done in Hungary, maybe, because of the murderous anti-Semitic regimes. Not in America. So it's really a crying shame that these practices, which may have been justified in different circumstances, have been transported across the Atlantic with no justification whatsoever. Maybe just we'll call it as a limud zchus, so people haven't realized that the times and places have changed, and they should certainly realize. So therefore, we have to be so careful in our activities. As a matter of fact, the Be'er HaGolem, as you can look up in Siman Shin Mem Ches, is the following remarkable statement. Discussions there about stealing from goyim, which is prohibited, and what if they made a mistake. In some cases, it's permissible. It's aveda. Oh, whole story. So he writes there on the side. The Be'er HaGolem is this book just gives you sources. Doesn't say anything, but he makes an exception. And he kosev zos ledoros. I'm writing this for generations. That there were those who pulled shtick and they fooled the goyim and they had these ill-gotten gains. At the end of the day, all the money went down the tubes. All the money went down the tubes. Nothing was left. Nothing was left. All was lost. But there were others who, to the contrary, they gave back money to non-Jews, even if they maybe didn't have to, technically speaking, as we said before, like Shimon ben Shetach. And they, quote, Godlu vitzlichu, they became wealthy, v'ashiru, v'hinichu yisrom v'olaleyem. They even had so much money that they left over to their children in inheritance. He's being practical. You think you'll pull what we'll call it in Yiddish, gnevish or shtick, what kinds of illicit transactions. Oh, great. Wrong, you're going to lose the money. That's what Barigola said. I mean, he lived in the 17th century. You're going to lose the money. Whereas if you're honest, you give away a lot of money, even big sums, you'll get it back. You leave it to your grandchildren. You know, there's a man, probably never heard of him. His name was Irving Bunim of blessed memory. He was a textile manufacturer when that was a very big business for Jews in New York City. He was a very strong supporter of Aaron Kotler. Zatzal, he was the president of RJJ, a school in Lower East Side which I attended. I remember him. He actually came to my shul once to be there for the naming of his great granddaughter, named after his wife. But he still is in our neighborhood. A very fine man. He was one of the founders of the Young Israel movement. Yeah, a great person. So his biographer, his son, wrote that in the 40s, he got a check for, I think, $25,000 in the 40s. What's that in today's world? Today? Who's good inside Sims? Anyone inside Sims? What's 25 grand in 1940? Now it's 70 years later. What would that be? What would that come up to? A million?
Yeah, sure.
A million. Okay. More?
Sure.
Okay, let's say a million. We have an estimate, $1 million. And he gave it back. He could have cashed it. No one knows the difference. It was a non-Jewish firm. He gave it back. His son says, they couldn't believe it. This tribune. You know, he wrote this check. He thought it was they paid twice. I don't know what it was. I don't even know what the details were. And he succeeded in his business, and his son succeeded in his business, and his granddaughter, his grandson-in-law is a multi millionaire. So the words of the Be'er HaGolem were fulfilled. I'll tell you, I know it for a fact. So we have to be very, very careful in the business world to be honest and to try to be Mekan Hashem Shemayim. Now the Smag says, Sefer Mitzvos Gadol, writing already, I would say 700, 800 years ago, that You know, there may be certain cases when, technically speaking, something is permissible. But the non-Jews, they're not stupid. They realize that they're being, something's ripped off over here. He said, even if it's technically speaking permissible, which it really isn't, it's a Chil Hashem. But you think that they won't discover it, a whole story. Nowadays, it's prohibited. You know why? Because you're preventing Mashiach from coming. He writes it. How so? How can Hashem send the Mashiach? It'll be a Chil Hashem. Why? Because the people say, God sends the Messiah to these crooks? They deserve the coming of the Messiah? So God doesn't send them. But if we will only do our share and be honest in business, and it'll be a Kiddush Hashem, then God can send the Mashiach. So he writes. The smart, we wrote this 100 years ago. Today we're much closer to the Mashiach. Just around the corner. Just be honest, and you can bring the Mashiach closer. Not a good enough reason, for nothing else. Okay. Much, much more can be said about the intricacies of monetary law. I'll just say one more thing, which is, according to Jewish law, yes.
Probably we'll address going to a store where they don't charge tax or dealing with a babysitter who doesn't charge, won't pay tax.
That's a more complex question, where the problem is not really your problem, it's the other person's problem.
But also, employing a babysitter who might be...
Wetback. Illegal immigrant. So I have a particular point of view on this, which is not so well accepted. I'll tell you what my view is. The government of the United States of America knows full well, as all the talk of reform of immigration is going on now, that there are tens of millions of illegal immigrants within their borders. And if you disagree with any of my facts, stop. I repeat it again. U.S. government and the state governments know that there are tens of millions of illegal immigrants in the United States of America. Correct? I think tens. Millions. I think it's tens, but you can say millions. I think that's for sure correct. The government is doing nothing to deport them, even though it knows full well of their existence. It's giving them health benefits, it's giving them all kinds of things, which, you know, they're checking at the hospitals. They're not going to die. What does the government want to happen with these people? They're unable to file for income tax, even if they want to, because they don't exist. What does the government want to happen? They can deport them. They can allow them to starve to death or to die of lack of health care. So the government is providing them health care. It's not deporting them. It seems to me it's a double portion, but the government wants they shouldn't starve to death either. They starve to death, they're going to go into the hospital and then it'll cost more money to bring them back from the dead. So the government wants them to have some employment. But the government doesn't allow them to be employed because they can't pay taxes. They don't exist. So what does the government want? What's the answer? What does it answer that question? What does the government expect? I'll give you my suggestion.
To do menial jobs.
The government, to do what?
To do the menial jobs.
Yeah, the government expects that they'll be paying these kind of jobs, which were quote unquote off the books, and people are paying them, and the government is can't say we can't sanction it, because... But the government is aware of it, and the government doesn't care about it. The government, in effect, maybe even wants it. They shouldn't starve to death. Now, of course, if you plan to be Attorney General, don't do it. We can call that nanny gate. You know, they find you had a nanny, didn't pay this. The nanny was. It goes on in the highest levels of Washington. No one was ever criminalized for not paying the nanny, because nanny can't pay. Half the nannies are wetbacks. You can't pay Social Security, they don't exist. So I don't think it's a particularly criminal for what to do that. If you can find someone who's willing to be on the books and pay the Social Security and they pay their tax, matova manor, I'm not opposed. It's great. But you often can't find someone like that.
And stores that don't charge tax?
These stores, do they exist, these stores? These are the same people. They're the same people who are the wet backs who run these stores. They're outside the street. When you walk in the streets and they're selling you all kinds of wares on the avenue. What's supposed to be with that? I'm sure some I'm sure are citizens and they're honest, but some are not citizens. They got here. I don't know how they got here. Across the Mexican border, I don't know how they got here.
I'm saying, with, let's say, a farm store.
Okay. I hope they're citizens. Hope they're paying taxes.
I'm saying that if they don't, do you have to pay taxes?
I don't. It's certainly not your responsibility.
But they say if you pay by credit card, we'll charge you tax. If you pay by cash, we won't charge you tax.
Pay by credit card. What's the problem?
Charge your tax.
Good.
Okay.
You want to know, is it absolutely prohibited to pay them by cash? If they already asked that question, then maybe yes. But if you just pay cash, I pay cash. So many places I pay cash. I walk into a gas station, I pay cash. So do I know he's paying? He's ripping off.
You know the minute in Brooklyn is that it happens like this.
I hope that not everyone in Brooklyn is in that category. And again, it's primarily the responsibility of the storekeeper. Primarily. I want to discuss one more thing about monetary issues before I go to broader issues of the workplace, which is Ve'ela v'shpotem asher tosu lefneihem. There are disputes in the world of business. Where is dispute resolution to take place? So Rashi tells us at the very beginning of v'shpotem, only lefneihem, v'lo lefnei ovdei elilim, which is a very strong prohibition against going to secular court. We don't realize that. There can be cases, I'm dealing with them now, two Orthodox Jews, they want to have the case in secular court. Not allowed. Even if they both agree, it's not allowed. Why? So if you look at in Rashi and the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, they're very strong expressions. The Miyak Hashem Alilim, Meirim Yad, the Torah Moshe Rabbeinu, and the Mechal as Hashem, all these expressions, I hope you know what they mean. It's bad. So therefore, you're not permitted to take somebody to secular court. Because you're not allowed to do it. If you think he owes you money, take it to a Bezin. If he refuses to go to Bezin, so the Bezin that you're summoning him to will presumably write you a letter saying he refuses to come and you're permitted to pursue it in the secular court. How's that possible? He needs Chazer to save him to get your money back. The answer is no. The answer is it's only prohibited if you choose to go to secular court. Because by choosing to go to secular court, you are enhancing, if you may, the name of that system as being superior to our system, which is the Chilul Hashem. But if I have no choice, the guy won't come to Beis Din, and he owes me money, so Beis Din will give me leave. He doesn't want to come to Beis Din. You're allowed to pursue your case in civil court. Okay? So it's not, there's no, not that you're doing a violation to get your money back. No violation in the first place. You're there against your will, in effect. I should add that arbitration is permissible. Because arbitration, like Beis Din, is a non-governmental body, and typically arbitrators are not required to rule in accordance with state laws. So you just say, okay, you're allowed to go to arbitration. So let's say the guy that refused to come to Beis Din, I heard bad things about Beis Din. Okay, let's go to arbitration. American Arbitration Association. That's okay. Keep that in mind. That's an option which you can pursue if the other fellow doesn't want to go to Beis Din for whatever reason. This is very, very important because, unfortunately, there's too many violations of this. Now, there are cases in which courts are permissible, where it's non-adversarial in nature, purely technical, you know. This could be for inheritance cases and things of this nature, just to probate the will, things of this type. If a person, in effect, was forced to go to secular court, either by a plaintiff, because he won't come, or as a defendant, because the guy who insisted taking him to secular court, which he's not allowed to do, then if you win the case, you keep the money. The question is why? That's a long story, but I'm giving you a psych and keep the money. If you win, is the guy like, oh, I want to take it to Beis Din now. I lost the court, let's go to Beis Din. Rav Moshe has nothing to do. You don't get two bites at the apple. You went originally to secular court and you lost. As plaintiff or as defendant, you lost. You can't go now reopen the case in the best. That's how we generally speaking accept it. All kinds of nuances. I'm not going to go into those right now. But I felt it was important at least to discuss this with you. And speaking about, just broadly speaking, there's one other area I wanted to focus on for a minute, which is employer-employee. That's a very common case of monetary law. Here too, we have a whole Shulchan Aruch. Yes, there are times when the Shulchan Aruch will take into account the laws of the land, the practices, the common practices of the land, the Gemara in Bavati Rishalmi. Minig Mevatal Halom. What do you mean? People at the minute of Mechal Shabbos and Mechal Shabbos? Chas v'shalom. It's in monetary context. There's a minig, it works such a man, such a man. So it's understood that when they get into involved in a deal, they had a mind according to the Minhag HaMedina. This is true in terms of employer-employee, terms of contract law, things of this nature, landlord tenant, all these kind of things. We assume they're going according to the understanding of the of the customary practices. Yes.
You have a law that's like a United States law, but it's not a Lafayette law. You still have to take the Jew to the, like, between two Jews, you still have to take them to
you
the
You must go to Bezdin. Absolutely must go to Bezdin. Bezdin will have to bone up on United States law. As a matter of fact, when I'm in those cases, I make sure I have a lawyer on the Bezdin. Not only as a consultant. On the Bezdin. He supposedly knows the U.S. law. So he'll be able to tell us. The law says this. I'll have to go consult outside. Okay? Even there are cases, and undoubtedly there are cases, when a Bezdin will apply, you know, local laws. No question about it. There are questions of whether you're allowed to put in the original deal that you want this case to be heard by Bezdin in accordance with local laws. That's a dispute among contemporary authorities. Okay?
And who argues your court? Who argues your case in opinion?
Well, in the Bezdin, ideally, as you know from the Mishnah and others, you should argue the case yourself. Right? Get up there and speak. If you're tongue-tied, so there's a concept called psach picha le'ilin. If someone is tongue-tied, you put somebody to represent him. And that's why there are many times in Batei Din, there are advocates. The problem with some of the advocates is they are not, they're bound by no moral code. We'll call it the Wild West. As opposed to attorneys, that can be disbarred. We can't disbar the people they call them in Hebrew, Tohanim. But they're just the rabbinical pleaders. They can do whatever they want. That's why we try in our best to stay away from all representation. Best if they talk themselves. Obviously, they have a right of U.S. law, New York law, to representation. If you take away that right, your ruling can be easily overturned in a secular venue. So we tell everybody you can have representation if you want. But if they want, we have attorneys who can be disbarred. We haven't disbarred any, but at least we can disbar them. There's one case where there was the potential of our getting involved for a disbarment. Some of us seems to have been a little bit unethical, but they had calmed down. Okay? Any other questions before I go on to my broader discussion? We spoke about a lot of important topics already so far today. Any other questions you have?
Yes? Can we discuss that with Rebus a little bit?
Rebus a little bit. It's a contradiction. You're not permitted to charge or to pay interest. That's right. Not only you can't take it, you even can't give. Giving ribbons to a Jew is prohibited. Ribbons, everyone agrees, is permissible in both directions from a non-Jew. As opposed to everything else we spoke about until then. That's clear. The definition of who's a non-Jew is not clear. Is the Chase Manhattan Bank Jewish or not Jewish? What do you think? The answer is both. What is a public corporation? What's Salach stats? Clear majority. Non-Jewish ownership, but even though some of our enemies think we own all the banks, but that's not real. Maybe say Halavai, but it's far from real. A very small piece of Chase Manhattan. It's a Rockefeller, started with Rockefellers, and it's a lot of not such pro-Jewish money. Well, I won't go into that now. But many assume that even a bank such as Chase Manhattan is considered non-Jewish for these purposes. Well, it's not completely clear why, but I think that's a minute in most places. So then you want to have interest with a non-Jew, with a Jewish person, you have to what we call a heter risk. I mean, it looks like a loan, but it's crafted as a business venture, or half loan, half business venture. There's presumed profits which constitute the alleged interest. Complicated, not for 1 minute. What I should say, I'll give one example of ribbons, only one, because it's so common. And it's likely a Torah prohibition, unfortunately. People don't realize why it's so. Take the following case, okay? Maybe you know about your case. You have a rich man, poor man. Rich man is well connected at the bank, and poor man has nothing. Poor man approaches rich man, you know, rich man, I need money, but I can't get it. No, my credit is not good. It's called credit rating. I'm not credit worthy, whatever it may be. Can you do me a favor? And go to the bank, you're credit worthy, you take out the loan, and I'll pay back the bank. Okay? Follow the case? Chase Manhattan will lend money to rich Reuven, RR, and poor Pinchas is paying back the money to the bank with interest. It's a Torah prohibition, gentlemen. It happens every day of the week. Why is it a Torah prohibition? Because as far as the bank is concerned, the bank never heard of poor Pinchas. They only know about rich Reuven. So in effect, what's happening is that poor Pinchas is paying off rich Reuven's debt with interest. Even though it's going to a non-Jew at the end, it makes it irrelevant. It's a Torah prohibition. It happens all the time. That's the most important halacha to talk about in the Chosrim. Don't do it. It's a Torah prohibition. What's your question?
So, I mean, it's always, in all cases, that would be prohibited.
You mean a partnership of two Jews, how they would deal with each other?
Yeah, let's say you're in a partnership and let's take one off in the bank, but you're not, you know, one person's got better credit score than the other person, so you're going to use that person. But then you're still both paying off.
That's a good question. You're asking an excellent question. That's a good question. I mean, that's what's it then? Yeah, a partnership wants to borrow $1 million from a bank. One of them is creditworthy, one is not. They each have $500,000 in the business as it is. They want to double their capital. So they both of them take out a... You know what? In that case, it's not so common because the bank is going to want to have the creditworthy guy on their loan. They don't want the other guy though. So I hope it won't happen too often. But it's a good question. I'm not sure. Maybe a problem if it does happen. Anyway, I wanted to devote the last few minutes of this year to areas of the business world which go beyond actual money. Question. Should you wear a yarmulke in the business world? Yes. Very common question. What do you think?
Yes.
I think you're right. Now, generations ago, most Orthodox men in the business world take their yarmulkes off. They're afraid of anti-Semitism, they don't want to stick out. We have to be grateful to members of other ethnic groups who seem to be able to exhibit their customs very unabashedly, publicly. As a result of that, the Jews were much more meek with a Gullus mentality until that time have become much more able to wear the yarmulkes at work. I believe the yarmulkes at work is a protection to some extent from the potential pitfalls at work. Aside from the area of Chosh and Mishnah that we were discussing, and actually Ribbis is really in Yoredeya, there are Orach Chaim considerations like wearing a yarmulke, and davening, it's hard to find a minyan sometimes, and there have to be at work at a certain time. Try very hard to find a minyan. If you can't, you're allowed to daven by yourself, if you can't. And of course, it's Shabbos considerations. Can I tell you a secret? This is when you're here, you're not allowed to work on Shabbos. You used to be thinking, ain't going to work on Saturday, huh? But that's very important to know. You got to tell your boss, whoever, I'm not working on Saturday. I'm leaving on Friday with ample time to get home for Shabbos. Don't leave late. Don't cut it close. Say, well, it takes me an hour to get home. On Friday afternoon in New York City, it takes twice as long. Heaven knows the roads. Twice at least. It's the worst traffic time of the week is Friday before Shabbos. It's a fact. Go by train better. Much better, safer by train. Trains work the same way. Cars get stuck. Anyone in a GW bridge, forget about it. Forget about it. People get stuck. They go on. They want to come to Riverdale, where I live. But you have to pass near the bridge. They get backed up for an extra hour. They have to walk from Harlem up to Riverdale. It's happened. And that's all part of Shabbos. It's to be careful before Shabbos, not only on Shabbos.
Does the person have to tell an employer at the interview, or can they wait until they're offered the job?
That's a good question. Strictly speaking, by law, they're not permitted to discriminate against you. Obviously, if you wear a yarmulke, they know who you are. Can you go into an interview without a yarmulke if you plan to wear the yarmulke at work and to keep Shabbos? Technically speaking, the answer is yes. Technically. But you know, I don't know if it's such a good idea.
For a woman to... It may not be clear that she's from, to the her not saying
that. Right, a woman, that's right. It's all must she's from. Another thing, must she say she's married? The law protects against that. The law does not allow you to ask her to be a single or married. The law. To fool anybody is still not a bad idea. It's a bad idea. Just don't say anything. I don't think you're required to say much because the law protects you. At the same time, if you have an alternative, it would certainly be better to have full disclosure at the interview. Because otherwise, they'll hold it against you. You withheld information from us. You say I'm protected by law. they'll get even with you, they'll have bad you, they'll harass you, they'll take it out on you and take everybody else. I don't think it's good policy if you can avoid it. If someone's desperate for a job, it's a different story. There's a law protection, as far as I know, in this country. Anyway, but I want to talk about the last few minutes is the fourth section of Shulchan Aruch, which is Evan HaEzer. You say, Evan HaEzer? Men and women? What in heaven's name does that have to do with the workplace? The answer is everything. You know, the workplace 100 years ago was an all-men's club. Yeah, women didn't work 100 years ago. Very rarely. I saw even less than 100 years ago, I saw a video of, I think it was Times Square, Herald Square, one of those main squares in New York City. Someone took a movie in the early 80s. When will movies start? Is this the silent movie? When did they start? Early 1900s? No. No. Not that far back. I don't think so. I think it was the earliest part of the 20th century. Less than 100 years ago. And you saw the street. 1920. Okay. We call that the 20th century. Okay, but...
I said 1900.
I'm sorry. Okay, so I think you're right. That's when they had the film. So 1920, something like that. So they had a film of Herald Square, Times Square. It was almost all men. There were some women. Go today, 50-50. 50-50? I think, am I right? Whoever walked in these main squares of the city. And besides which, they were dressed one way in the 1920s, and they dressed a different way in the 2010s. Which makes you use the word undressed a different way in the 2010s. How does a frum Jewish man survive halachically in such a decadent and promiscuous and permissive environment? Only by making gedorim for yourselves, erecting fences for yourselves, you're not going to be entrapped in illicit behavior of any sort. You have to watch your eyes. Difficult to watch your eyes when the women are naked in the office. I use the word naked in a, say half naked, okay, it's a charity. They don't dress properly. I'm not telling you what you don't know. A man has to watch. It says, Lo Sasu Achrei Nechen. You have to watch what you look at. Okay. More than that, you have to be careful about the whole atmosphere that goes on in the workplace. The atmosphere, I've never worked in those places. I work in Yeshiva University. It's pretty good working conditions. The salary is not exactly the same as downtown, but but okay, we have other benefits. I'm told by my Talmidim or lawyers that they stopped going to the water cooler. So they go to the water cooler, they had a drink, you know? Stopped going. Why? Because the scuttlebutt at the water cooler is about who has an extramarital affair with whom? That's what they talk about at the water cooler. You know, so he says it's crazy. You stop going to the water cooler because that's all they're talking about. And they're not talking explicitly about this man, this woman. When they sit around the table, they're telling off-color jokes. Now the Gemara tells them the Masechta Shabbos Aflam Gimel and Aleph. Hakol Yodim Kala Lama Nichlas Lechup. Everyone knows why a kala enters into a chuppah with a husband. They know what goes on there in the bedroom, etc. Everyone knows. We all know. But kala menabalas piv, whoever dirties his mouth, even if he has 70 years worth of good deeds, it's all thrown into the garbage. But the worst is the next sentence. Af hashomea v'shosek. Everyone who listens and is quiet. That means you are deputized by God Himself to protest when you can protest. Now, protests can take different forms. So you can say, you can't talk that way. This is foul talk. It's profanity. Very often you can't do that at work. You can't be God's policeman at work. There's a different protest. You walk out. And after all, they're going to get it that, this guy Chaim, he's a prude. He's a square. He's a nerd. We tell these off-color joke, he walks out. That's a Kiddush Hashem. It's a Kiddush Hashem. Because whatever word they will attach to you, prude, nerd, I don't know where they're probably from. There are probably many new words that I don't even know about, words from 20 years ago. You know? They'll understand that you hold yourself to a higher standard. You're not going to talk these words, you're not going to use them in your vocabulary, And when they were put in other people's vicarity, you're going to walk out. What you may not do is to go drink with your co-workers. This is Meisim B'chol Yom. They work 9 to 5, they get longer, and they have to get rid of the tension. Especially those high tension, well-paying jobs, they got to drink. It's the first step to decadence, depravity, immorality, and the breakup of Jewish values. I'm speaking from knowledge. It's very dangerous out there. You guys, I'm looking at you guys, you're all, you know, presentable, young, tall, strong. The girls will be after you. And watch out. Try to make it dark. Say, no. Don't allow yourself to drink. I don't want to tell stories now. It's too painful to tell. But take it from me. One drink and clean.
What's the story?
Okay. All right. Rabbi, tell the story. I'll tell one story. And then I'll end because it's one final story. Just to show you how bad things can get. I was sitting and learning the base medrash. We used to learn in the third floor first. That's what our base medrash always was. Shem Kadmonius. And the phone rings on the cell, on the, what cell, the window cell phone, on the payphone. The payphone rings and someone's calling for me, a rabbi in a particular community. I received a phone call from a woman who described herself as a base Yaakov graduate, whose husband has smich. This is a tale of woe. She went to a business meeting in Las Vegas. As you know, Las Vegas is probably the number one convention center for business in the country. I think so. Is that still true?
Still true.
Okay. Now, Las Vegas is not Ir HaKodesh. No one ever used the word. No one ever said Ir HaKodesh Las Vegas. I've never heard those terms in the same breath. It's an era of, we know, gambling. But gambling often goes together with znus. Let's call it spade a spade. She tells the following story. She had a very difficult day at business. You know, this business meeting with a lot of tension. And she just wanted to relieve some of the tension. So she made the mistake of going to the lobby. There's always a bar. She ordered a drink. That was the end. That's the beginning. At the end, at the beginning of the end. When you drink, and when you drink, who drinks alcohol over here? I'm against it vehemently. One of the reasons I'm against it is this story. I'm a vehement opponent of even taking one drink for this reason. Okay, she took a drink. What drinks do, I'm told, I mean, all I drink is wine for Kiddush and for Purim and for Abakosis, that's it. But, maybe a sip of the bris, okay. Bench or something like that, that's it. I'm told that heavy liquor, you know, removes your inhibitions. I guess particularly maybe more for a woman who couldn't hold the liquor. I think liquor depends on how big you are, right? How diffused over the body. Yeah. I never met the woman. Mentioned that most women are smaller than men. The same shot of liquor for a woman removed her inhibitions. Okay. Now she's still sitting there at the lobby, and a guy walks over to her. Can I buy you a drink? My boy said, what does that mean? Anyone knows anything knows. You can't say yes. There's no way you can say yes to that. But because she already had a drink, she said yes. Okay. Step two. So now she already had a second drink, and the second bought her by this dude. Third. Can I walk into your room? Oh, man. What are you, crazy? You know what that means? But she already had two drinks. So she said yes. And now she wants to know, is she permissible to a husband, or is she prohibited to a husband? Because the Torah tells us that a woman who committed adultery is prohibited to a husband. The Beis Yaakov graduate, whose husband has smicha. Calling a rabbi, who calls me on the payphone right here on the third floor. So, there are some authorities, I'm not passing on this show, I'm not discussing halacha of Ibn Ezra, I'd say that if a condom was used, some want to say it's not considered to be an act of adultery because there's something in between. So I said, you know, maybe the fun rabbi will accept that. So I said, ask her if she used a condom. So I said, how could she not use a condom? The guy's a stranger from the street and the AIDS all over the place. So the rabbi said, no, she didn't. So I said, yeah, what's she worried about AIDS? I asked her that question. What did she say? Well, I asked the guy if he had AIDS, and he said no. Huh? Did he say yes? The halakh question is complex. Is a husband allowed a believer? And if the husband allowed a believer, you have to tell him. But that's not for today's discussion. I'm so frightened of the workplace. I've heard so many stories about workplace which are threatening to Jewish marriages and threatening to Jewish morality. Even if not all of them are true, I've heard enough that I know are true to cause me to end this shiur on this note. Yes, Hoshe Mishra is very important. Your day is important. Aruch Chaim is important. Maybe the biggest danger you will face in your workplace is Ebenezer. So be careful. And if you be careful, just as you're Mekadosh Shem Shemayim Barabim, by your being honest in business, you're Mekadosh Shem Shemayim Barabim, people realize that you are not part of this decadent society. You are an Am Kodesh. We read this parasha this week. Kedoshim to you. Thank you for listening.